Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that eight-show-a-week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to part two of Stage's conversation with stage titan Anthony Warlow. Anthony has been thrilling audiences from the moment he arrived on the theatrical scene, and has successfully inhabited a diversity of roles in opera and musical theatre. Anthony Warlow created the role of Enjolras in the premier Australian production of Les Miserables and was cast in the title role of the Phantom in Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera when it first debuted in Australia, a role he returned to some 17 years later. He delivered a commanding performance in Lucy Simon's The Secret Garden as Archibald Craven. Another collaboration with Miss Simon provided him with an opportunity to create a role for the stage, that of Dr. Yuri Zhivago in Dr. Zhivago, the musical. His craft is masterful. His talents extensive. His presence magnetic. Is it any wonder that Anthony Warlow has left an indelible stamp on the industry, both at home and abroad?
This is the moment. This is the day when I send all my doubts and demons on their way. Every endeavor I have made ever is coming into play, is here and now, today. This is the moment. This is the time when the momentum and the moment are in rhyme. Give me this moment, this precious chance. I'll gather up my past and make some sense at last. This is the moment.
Jekyll and Hyde, another iconic album,
yeah,
which everyone was listening to in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be the definitive performance. Had Bob Cuccioli done it on Broadway yet? It hadn't had to say, it was a concept album, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a concept album.
Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, there was one album before that that Linda had done with Colm Wilkinson. And I was doing... my albums had been out. And I remember... going to New York and going into Colony Records when it was still there and looking at it. And it was Mark or Mike behind the counter, and he saw me. He said, oh, Mr. Warlow, he said, come here, we got a cabinet just for you. And he had a key with a locked cabinet, and there were my three albums in this cabinet. And so they were selling them, and they're probably selling them for, you know, $50 American. But so it was out there in the ether. I was doing My Fair Lady with the Victorian State Opera Company, and Leslie Bricus was in town in Melbourne doing Scrooge with Keith Michelle at the Princess Theatre, and I got a call, would I have lunch with him? So I did. Leslie and I did lunch, so we did that, and he said that Frank Wildhorn was a friend of his, and he'd written the lyrics for this concept album that they wanted to put the full show together of Jekyll and Hyde. And would I be interested in... Frank was a great fan, and his wife at the time, Linda, Edda, he just thought that our two voices would blend beautifully. And I said, I'd love to. So after, that was 95, early 95, 94, beg your pardon, Phoebe was born. She was in the tummy at the time. So I got on the plane and went over and stayed with Frank and Linda in their house in Beverly Hills. And we would just sit in the lounge room and talk, and I'd impersonate, and we'd do all those silly things. And it ended up being a really wonderful collaboration. And he said, it's going to be, you know, we've got time to do this. And he brought university friends of his to play other characters. And there are some people there now that, you know, Brad Oscar was one of them, singing the ensemble. And Christine Petty was doing character voices in the show. And we went to a number of studios. The big thing about it was that it was not done in chronological order. So I had this diary, and it was about vocal changes and physical changes mentally, how we were going to do this, how I was going to perform this. Nothing was done with orchestra except for, I think we had some horn sections for the ensemble of the Board of Governors, the only time we had any kind of orchestration. Everything else was done with a keyboard. So I had to, I would say what to Kim Schoenberg, who was doing the orchestrations, I said, Kim, what have we got here? How many horns? Is it horn heavy? Is it string heavy? He said, and what kind of, you know, electronic instruments are we using here? So we'd sit down for hours and just talk about all that, and I'd write it in the book, and I'd say, okay, well, these are the tones that are coming in and the colours that are coming in. And so we then went to Peter Frampton's studio in Los Angeles to record This Is The Moment. And it was at about, I think, about 8 o'clock at night. And I'd get in the car with Frank and go down to the studio, and Linda would be there, and she had a gold microphone. And I said, look, I use a Neumann 47 and a Neumann 67. And so Eric, who was the engineer, who was Barbara Streisand's engineer as well, he said, oh, I know those, great. He said, yeah, I will bring those in. So they ended up using mine for Linda as well, because the other one was a digital thing and mine was Valve, just a warmer sound. Mm. And I said, that's the only thing I'm going to ask, that I can use my mics that I'm used to. So we used those that night. And I, Jeremy, who was up in about two floors up with his keyboard, with all his computers around him, and he had a monitor watching me. I couldn't see him, but I could hear it. And I'm going to the headphones, and this wonderful crystalline da 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 da, and I sang This Is The Moment. I said, give me some time just to work out what's happening here, because the next thing was going to be the transformation, which we did almost a week later. So I had to then edit those moments in my head. It was tough, and so we put it all together. And the one thing I did say was that it was part of the contract that I said, I want nothing touched with an auto tune. I don't want my voice changed at all, except for the transformation, but the world has gone insane, which was done as a Berlin techno track, really, because of the clubs in Berlin.
Right.
And so Frank was doing this. He was very clever, because he was thinking, okay, if this goes international, the Germans are going to love this sort of dicka-dappa, dippa-dappa, bum-bum, doo-doo. And so that it ended up not being in the show.
Right.
I went to see a production in Bremen, which was at a place where they do a lot of Wagner, this huge set that could turn like a cube that could move around and shift for Wagnerian operas. And that's that. The World Has Gone Insane was done in that production, where the set became like a padded cell, and the Jekyll was in a straitjacket, and he was flying, and the world has gone insane, and then these big pyrotechnics would be going, flames everywhere. And I thought, okay, that's a great number, but it doesn't make much sense, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was cut from a lot of things, but the Germans loved it. And so that was kind of the way the thing was done. And right at the end, my suggestion to Frank, and he was very open to all this, I thought, to be honest, just as a precursor to this, I thought I'd be going in and they'd be saying, we want you to do this, we want you to sing it like this, this is how we're going to do it, this is the sort of timbre of the voice we want to use. But no, they had me and they said, carte blanche. And I'd gone in with so much research, read the novel, saw the movies, and I said, look, you know, the final scene, why don't we do it like a radio play? You know, the gunshots and the this and the, oh, Lisa. And I said, the movie version with Spencer Tracy, where visually, you know, it's the old-fashioned special effects, but he changes from the sort of the grinning Hyde into the handsome Jekyll. And I thought, I can do that vocally by going, Lisa, 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 ah, dying. And the ah, the aspiration at the end comes from Tito Gobbi when he sings Scarpia in Tosca, which is my favourite opera. It's the last thing where he dies, and she's, you know, she says all of Rome trembled, and he says, ah, aspirata. He goes, mori, mori. And that's where all those little elements came from. So it was all sort of a mind history putting together. And I didn't hear it for about 3 months. And all of a sudden, I was at home, and a courier came with a disc, two discs. And I put it on, and I this thing started. And the narration, which Hannibal Lecter, Silence of the Lambs, was sort of a big hit at the time. And I said to Frank, I'd like to do this a bit like Anthony Hopkins. In each of us, there are two natures. Clarice. And that was the beginning of that sort of madman coming in.
Yeah.
So that's the Jekyll and Hyde story.
Was there talk that you would do it on stage? I mean, you eventually did many years later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there's a concert version.
Were you wooed?
I did. Ended up doing a workshop for a new production. There was the production that was going to be done in Australia. John Frost was going to do it. He said, would you be interested? And I said, look, I'd be interested in doing the workshop. And I picked that up because I had never done the show from beginning to end. As a project, it was always all over the place. So I thought, well, this might be a way without you know. I will say this: the reason I did the vocal pyrotechnics on the recording is because I knew that it was going to be a concept recording, and I had this thing. Whether I would do that 8 times a week is another story, but at the time I was vocally able, and it was thrilling to me to be able to do that. And yes, I could hold notes on and all that sort of business. So Christopher Renshaw was engaged to work on doing a new production for Australia. And I was in New York at the time. I was about to do Man of La Mancha, just before I went off to Washington. And I did 2 weeks of a workshop with him and some wonderful girls who were in shows at the time. And We changed a little bit of the script. We worked on, there was going to be a poker game where Hyde would be there winning and then turning the table up and the chips would go over. It was great concept, great ideas. And so we did it. And then in came all the producers and there was a room full of people and they're all excited. And I was there with my goatee, And we started and we did it. I sang the show through and I was exhausted at the end of it because, you know, you've got 2 weeks to put it together. And then John was there and Bernadette Hayes, and they took me to dinner afterwards and they said, so I think Linda Terracini was there as well. So what do you think? Are you going to do it? I said, no. I've done it now. I've actually, for me, I've done it.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to do that 8 times a week. And I think they were flabbergasted. So then they came back and then there was the production that I think Darling Lucy was going to play Lucy Maunder. And Teddy Taha Rhodes, it was the opera doing all that.
Yeah.
And then it fell apart. But that was just the fact that I had physically done it, vocally done it, I should say. And then, rightly so, 2019, a friend of mine at the time approached me and said, you know, would you consider doing this? I said, you know what, look, maybe I should try to get it out of my system and do it. And so we did these two performances, one in Melbourne, one in Sydney, and the second performance, there was a cast member who had a dreadful cold and was wanting to talk about shows and things with me, and then I realised about 2 days later and I was about to go to Sydney to do it, so I didn't go to any rehearsal, stayed in the hotel, steamed and powered through that night, thinking I don't have to do this tomorrow, but I'll give what I can give tonight. And I will say this, that, you know, I'm not one to listen to reviews or to read reviews. I when someone said, oh, it's a great review, I say, okay, well, it's presented to me, and it's hard to listen to something that's negative, but there was something on one of the social media sites that said, a girl said that she'd been to see the show in Sydney, and Warlow was cracking and sort of, he's too old. And I thought, well, that's just one opinion.
Yeah.
But you know, those things, they touch you. Mm. But I thought, that's okay, I've done it now. I don't have to do it again. You know?
Do you prick me? Do we not bleed?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the truth of the matter. You know?
Have a sip of your coffee. I'm just going to read a bit of a grocery list.
Okay.
Dr. Jekyll, Yuri Zhivago, Archibald Craven, Archibald Grosvenor, Oliver Warbucks, Mr. Hyde, Sweeney Todd, Don Quixote, Professor Henry Higgins, Gabriel Eisenstein, The Wizard, The Phantom, The Pirate King, The Learned Judge, Enjolras, Max, Tevye, Teen Angel, Coco, Captain Edward Smith, Captain Corcoran, Captain Hook, Dolly Levi, Frederick Egamon, Skye Masterson, and Billy Flynn. Now, which role did you not play?
Irma La Douche. The Douche. The Douche.
Irma the Douche.
Oh, God, that's quite a list, isn't it?
Yeah. I assume it was Dolly Levi.
When the Dolly Levi thing was, yeah, that Hello
was a,
Dolly.
That was a red herring.
Yeah, it was, because that was the Bobby Darin version that we did on the recording, which was of Hello Dolly.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
on
yes.
the back. Was it, I can't remember now. Taste the Music, I think it might have been.
Yeah.
With the brilliant Tommy Tico, who I said to him, I said, I literally want to do this sort of Nelson Riddle-esque stuff. I said, I'd love to do this Bobby Darin version of Hello Dolly, which is based on Mac the Knife. And so we did, and it just kept going up. And he said, well, we'll do key changes, because he loved my key changes. And it just kept going up. And then the next verse would go up, and the next one would go up again. And I remember with Tommy, I said to Ken Lang, who was his manager at the time, I said, why are there so long intros into my song and so long outros from my song? He said, it's $12 a bar. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But brilliant. I mean, these you know, from what we could get in Australia, he came from that era, you know, the Channel 7 and the Tonight Shows and all that sort of business, and he just knew his stuff. And he actually said to me, because I was a little bit worried about whether I loved the style, but whether I could actually swing. There's a difference. People can sing that stuff, but they may not be able to swing it. And this is where the back phrasing and stuff comes in. And it's that challenge of, you know, starting off slowly, but then finishing at the right point. And he said, Anthony, you can swing. You can do it. I said, thanks, Tommy. And we started doing this. We did a couple of albums together.
Yeah, the great Tommy Tico.
Mm.
That's an extensive list there. I mean, it's the envy of any leading man on the globe. Is there a role that you felt you didn't quite master? Or do you leave a role, say goodbye to it, quite satisfied with?
Oh, gee whiz. Well, I wouldn't say mastering any of them. I mean, it's to be able to infiltrate those bones.
Your interpretation.
Yeah, my interpretation. And what I try to do in everything I do is to do a research, create a history, but at the same time put my own signature on it. Now, whether that's a vocal signature or a physical signature, I love physicality in particular. I had a great time playing with the GNS characters with physicalities. When we did Pirates, for instance, I said, you know, the Pirates of the Caribbean was the big hit at the time, and I said, will we be in trouble with Disney if I do a Johnny Depp? I said, What about if we did Johnny Depp from the head to the chest, and then the rest of it can be your costuming, which is what we did. But it was all, you know, the wobbling head and the finger in the air, and the voice was a little more like that, you know, it's Johnny Depp. And so I had a great time doing that, and it was all about fingers. And I listen, I find patterns in the score and think, okay, that's, if that's a flute doing a particular thing, that might just be the fingers on the gun. So I'm now doing fingers on the gun, ladies and gentlemen. So all those elements become part of my characterization. Yeah. And they help to sort of create the arc for me, so I don't get, the train doesn't derail halfway through.
The physicality is very important. So you like to build from the outside in?
Like a Laurence Olivier.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, an actor who I just thought was incredible, and of his time, you know, the great doyen of the theatre at the time. But he worked from the outside in, and while he was still a great technician, he admits that he said, you know, when he was young, he was very gesticular, and his acting coach would say, you don't need to do that. And I've tried to keep an open mind with every director that I've worked with, to take in, rather than just going, he's telling me to do this, okay, but listening to them, and if they have any advice, suck it up, take it in, you know. And so all those elements that Olivier would work on, for instance, I remember doing the character of Jacques Offenbach, which is written in a triple bill that the opera did, which was trial by jury, and I played the defendant, a role that was too high for me, but Richard wanted me to do it, so I did. And in the same night, we had, so it was trial by jury, a Papillon, which was a ballet, Lois Strike and Kelvin Coe, I think at the time. And then the final opera was a Offenbach comedy piece called Bataclan. And in that, the role of Offenbach was written for me to play as the narrator of his own story. And so there was a wonderful woman by the name of Marie Claire, who was our French coach at the opera. And she would diligently take me into the room, and we would work on the French, because I had to say, it was all in French, so learning my French with her. And I never forget, she said, you are too young for this role, too young. And I said, well, I haven't got the makeup on, and I'm designing, you know, I saw the design that was done. Kenneth Rahl did the designs, and I still have this design of Offenbach in my home. And I looked at the image, and I thought, okay, I'll get the putty out, and I'll give the big French nose, the hook nose, and I had chops, and I had a wig, and big green coat and monocle, did the makeup. Okay, and I did it myself. Graham Muir was a fantastic makeup artist, and he taught me a lot. So in those days, we had our makeup kit, and we would have to do it. It was none of this going to the room and having, sitting there and, you know, sucking on a beer and having someone do your makeup. We had to do it ourselves. And so we learnt, and I thank God I did the La Mancha stuff before. And I came out for the first tech run, and Marie Claire came back to my room and said, oh my goodness, I did not know it was you. I thought it was Dennis Olsen. And I took that as a great compliment. Yeah, great compliment. And I thought, yeah, Dennis could have done this, you know. But c'est de beaucoup la frisée, mon fidèle cochonnier. Now that was Spallanzani. I can't remember what the Offenbach was. Something about bagage and taxi. Whatever. But that was the Bataclan. I don't know, I've gotten lost now.
Well, we're talking about building a character.
Oh, building characters,
and,
yes.
Know, and the look,
and
is
so that
important.
Was the look. And when I saw myself in the mirror, I thought, yeah, this is it. And then I'd morph into the voice and the physicality, and then I'd feel confident enough to go out in front of 1,200 people.
Yeah, and those choices of you know, your finger action talk about, or a particular gait.
Yes.
Do you find that, you know, during the day, the next day, you're at the shopping centre and there's a bit of residue of the character that sort of...
No, actually, no. I can drop it off at home. As soon as I get home, finish, done. Of course, the energy stays on for a few hours, but I can just easily just drop that. And speaking of the physicality, when we did Phantom, Hal was extraordinarily wonderful as a director, and very laconic. He would just say one word. and I get it. And that's kind of the way I work. And I feel sometimes in a room, I stand there and I might present as being sort of something maybe critical or just nonplussed, but I'm actually taking a lot in, and I hear one word, and I never forget both Hal and Cameron when we were when I was auditioning for Phantom. Cameron came, I was doing Les Mis at the time at the Princess Theatre, and we were auditioning, we were all there on stage, and I at the last minute I thought I'd be a surefire winner for Raoul because of Ange Arras and having done Sky.
And you were still quite young.
I was young. Yeah, I was young. And so I was 27, 28.
And Crawford was in his 50s.
Yeah, yeah, he was older. So I was asked to do that. We did the original auditions, and it was about, you know, you had to come and sing an aria. So, okay, so I went in as Raoul, First of all, I auditioned for Raoul and Phantom. So I went into this room, and they're all at the end, and I sang the Count's aria because it was actly, and it was in Italian, and it was operatic. And I remember going to the audition with my hair. I slicked my hair back to look like that image of the Phantom with the slick toupee.
Yeah.
And I sang, and James Thane came out, and he said, "We want you to come back." Like tomorrow, whenever it was, and sing for Raoul. And I thought, okay, well, that's the role I'm sort of in for. But we want you to have your hair like floppy, dry and floppy. Okay, so I did. And then the next thing was going in for the main auditions at the theatre, standing on the Les Mis stage at the Princess. So, and they said, we want you to sing Music of the Night. I said, well, I don't know it. I didn't know because I was doing other things, and it was all I asked of you is what I'd learned. I remember being backstage, and I was about to go on, and Cameron came up in the crossover, and he said, "Just want to say one thing. The Phantom is dangerous." That's all he said. Hal used the same word in rehearsal. That's all he said, one word. And I thought, yeah, okay, but I don't know this aria, this song. So I was nervous as well, and so part of that energy, that sort of, you know, damn you, you know, the mea culpa came out. Anyway, so I actually had a bit of a, dare I say, a bit of a turn. So I went on stage, I had done the Raoul, and they said, thank you, and I had to come back to do Music of the Night, and I walked on, I said, look, I'm sorry, I don't know the aria, this is the song, would you mind if I held the music? They said, of course. So I sang that, and as best I could. And then the next thing was, we want you to do The Angel, which was the falsetto, I gave you my music. And at the end of it is, you will curse the day you did not do all the Phantom asked of you. So the poor pianist, I don't know what it was, upright piano, stage left, and I sang this thing, I kept the note going, you, na 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 na, and boom, and walked off. Wasn't even waiting for them to say thank you. Just walked off. And apparently, this is the story, that Andrew Payne, who was the company manager at the time, he had overheard Al turn to Cameron and say, we found our Phantom. And so then it was announced a week later that, you know, I was it. But I still had to finish the Les Mis season and went straight into Phantom. I think we had 6 weeks break, and then I went into rehearsal in Sydney.
The Phantom was probably the third big Cam Mac show to arrive after Cats and Les Mis.
That's right.
And I imagine a lot of that ensemble of Les Mis were auditioning for Phantom.
Yes, they're all there.
What was it like doing the show every night with everybody having a stake in the next Cam Mac show?
A little tense. A little tense, to be honest. You know, people it was that thing of, we've got a show to do here tonight, but they were more concerned. Some were more concerned about how am I going to get through this audition tomorrow. But those, you know, they're fleeting. That happens. But once it was all over, and then it was okay, get back to the show, and then we had to wait before any kind of announcement was being made. And it was a big deal for me. You know, it was a tough time, really tough time. Again, youngest person in the world to do it.
Did you do your own makeup?
No. No, I didn't. But I will say this, that I was blessed by having Bob McCarran, I think his name was, who was the makeup artist who was in charge of putting it together. And I did have a conversation with Hal and saying, you know, I know that when Crawford, I saw the images of Crawford, I'd never seen the production. I was invited to go to New York to have a look at it, to London, I should say, to have a look at it.
Had it played New York yet?
I don't know. I think it was London when we... you would have been. Yes, you're right. But this was London.
Mm.
And I said, no, I don't want to see it. I'd rather just create my own and trust Hal will, you know, he'll guide. And so I'd seen the images of Crawford and I had the book, you know, the Phantom of the Opera book with all the images and what have you in it. And I saw this weird face with a perfect ear. And I thought, I understand it could be a burn or it could be a birthmark. I went down the birthmark part and deformed at birth. And I said to Hal, I said, look, I feel quite confident vocally and my ears are good. So could we, in the prosthetics, have an ear that sort of melted into the head? So it's just a tiny little hole, as if the ear is gone, which gives him a sense of unbalance. And I could go on forever about the character that I created for this thing, but he said, yeah, he said, if you're happy with it, that'd be great. So let's have a look at it. And so I mentioned it to Bob. Bob worked on this stuff. And I remember I was living in Hawthorne at the time in Melbourne with the show. And he came to the house and he put all the peppermint gunk all over my head to create the cast and then create the makeup on it. And the piece, it looked fantastic. It looked like I had a normal ear on the left, and then when this mask was on, it was just the mask and nothing. So it was weird. So that worked for me. So I went on with that. Had I known after doing the 2007 to 2009 production of that, I would have shaved my head in 91, because it was putting that mask, that skull cap on, and the heat that generated, it would dribble down my face. People thought I was bleeding at one point because there was a red light and it was dripping off the thing onto the stage. They said, are you okay? I said, no, well, I'm fine. But then I'd take it off and this sweat would just fall out of my mask. So having done it without any hair, where the prosthetics were just put on,
yeah,
and painted, and then all the heat came out, didn't sweat a minute.
Wow.
In the second incarnation of the show. So there were elements of it that were difficult because it was the first in Australia. I did feel a little like I was a Disney character being pushed around on roller skates, that they were shoving costumes and trying things on me and pushing here. And it was a tough kind of environment to be in. And of course, toward the end of the time, I was getting sick. Didn't realise it, but I was getting sick.
Yeah. Is it a solitary experience playing the Phantom?
Very. It was for me. I couldn't leave the theatre between shows. They were kind enough to bring me a television to the room, so if I wanted to watch something between shows, I could. I rarely watched it, but it was very solitary getting in there 3 hours before, in those days, 3 hours before for makeup, doing the show, and then waiting on two show days, you know, a good couple of hours before you got the second, and then everyone left because you're still getting the makeup off, and then debriefing vocally and physically, having a shower, and then going home. To then come back and do it all again.
It's a big work day.
Big work day. I'm pleased I did it. I'm proud of the work that I did in it. But the background, the backstory that I gave him was pretty simple, and I talked to Hal about this. I won't say naive way, but in an enthusiastic way, I'd present ideas to him that I felt were appropriate for this character. For instance, when he is presenting himself to Christine or any public, He is perfect, but it's in great pain that his body naturally is the phantom that throws her into the lair in the final scene. And it's all at the time there was can't remember of he's a pop singer, and he did a he basically does a pop. It's one of those boy band guys who took off on his own, and he does a strip, and he strips down to muscle, and then you see the skeleton dancing.
Oh yes.
You know who I mean?
Yeah.
It's, so that was
he played the grand final last year.
Yeah, that's right. That's my idea. That was my idea.
Robbie Williams.
Thank you. So Robbie Williams was my idea of that video that I'd seen.
Yeah,
and I thought that underneath all this is that muscle, all the muscles. And so when he throws her in at that final scene, that's what he is, his head. He's not trying to hold his head up anymore.
Mm.
He's a monster. Mm. And so, but he's not a two-dimensional gargoyle. Mm. And that's what made it doubly tough for me, because I wanted to give him a reality. And I think I achieved it in part, and that the voice and everything when he was in front of her was trying to be perfection. And the hands, because he had a lack of physicality, his hands, almost like a blind person, his hands were doing the work for him, and they were more balletic and soft and romantic.
Mm.
And he was wooing her with physicality.
So doing it again 10 years later?
Yeah.
About 10 years later? You're older.
Yeah.
You've had the cancer.
Yeah.
Was it an easier gig?
Yes, in a lot of ways.
You're about to make the character even richer with experience.
Yeah, and going back to Jekyll and Hyde, because I'd had the chemotherapy. So when we, and I'm sorry to skip here, but when we went down that path of the transformation, and he sings, like a warning light shimmering in red, like silver bloodshed. One of the chemicals that were put into me was a red vial. So I used that moment, and that change in my body was used in that. And the same thing with the Phantom the second time round. When we did it originally, while people had the recordings, and the aficionados wanted to know all about it, and they'd been to London to see it or New York, we were really kind of teaching the Australian audience what the show was. So it was more vocally, for want of a better word, perfect for the audience to try to create. These are the songs. These are the moments. The second time, in the second incarnation, people knew what the show was. They'd seen it many years before. So I was able to play more with the actorly approach and throwing away certain, still with money notes, but throwing away certain, dare I say, pretty vocals to really enhance the character. And that was demanding in its own way and tiring, but it paid off, you know. So that was that. And the good thing about that season was that it was broken up. So it wasn't 2 years of just constantly doing it. We did it for 6 months and then somewhere else. It was easier.
I think you were doing a press junket for Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah.
You'd been cast as Pontius Pilate.
Pilate, yeah.
In that Arena Spectacular produced by Harry and Miller.
That's right.
When you got the cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
What alerted you that something
I knew I was doing it. I was about to go on to the press junket for it. And I was living in Melbourne. And I felt heavy. I felt physically heavy. And you know sometimes when you bend over and the blood rushes to your head and you feel that... You can feel the sense of the blood rushing through. That happened a lot. And then I was just sitting watching television one afternoon and was playing with my, just under my ear, just up by the jaw. And I felt this little sort of like a cysty thing. And I thought, that's weird. And it wasn't getting bigger, but I was able to move it around. I thought, that's strange. It's like it's not staying where it is. So in the family, we have relatives who are medicos, and I rang someone and said, look, you know, this is happening, what do you think? And they said, oh, maybe you should just have someone have a look at it. So I thought, okay, well, when I come to Sydney, I'll go and visit such and such. So I was, at the same time, I was doing promotion for the second album on the boards, and I was doing a launch at Rip and Lee and a few other things. And I got on the plane, got to Sydney, got out of the car, and almost collapsed. I thought I'm gonna faint. So I went in and I said, I think I need to, Ian, who was the doctor at the time, to come and see me. And he invited the head and neck surgeon from RPA to come and have a feel. And so he went down my left side, right side, and he went, okay, he said, there's nothing on the left side, it's more than the right. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, that means that if it's anything, it hasn't travelled, which is a good thing. Okay, I had no idea. But I just knew that I sat down on that bed and put my head on the pillow and the room was spinning around. And he said, well, tomorrow we'll do a biopsy. And they said, do the press launch. Okay, so I'm there with Angry Anderson and John and John Stevens and all this business. And I was nervous as hell, and I did it. And I saw some images of the news thing, and my face was blown out. And I thought, it's just stress. It's just tiredness and stress from working and not really having a big break. So then I went to have this thing done, did it. And they said, if it's nothing, you can still do the tour, and we might just take it out and be fine. So turned out that it was lymphoma. And so I had to stop the tour and went in and got the thing removed, and quite a big scar. But of course the press picked up on, they thought, oh well, it's near there, it's got to be throat cancer. Well, it wasn't, nothing to do with throat cancer. It was under the ear and it was a lymph node. And
was there a concern that your voice might be affected?
I was concerned, right. I didn't know. And so isn't it funny how human nature takes over? But I said, I want the best anaesthetist in the country. I said, I don't want anyone to scratch my cords. If they're going to shove those things down, I intubated. I don't want to be, you know, hurt in any way. And they did. They were very kind. And the top head surgeon, head and neck surgeon at RPA was Chris O'Brien, was the man who saved my life. And he said to me, I'll never forget, he said, first of all, we're going to go in and it'll either be a small scar. So he put his fingers, you know, about two inches, or it'll be a large scar. He said, the worst that may have to happen is that we may have to cut and lift your face. And I thought, Phantom, here we go. Yeah. Now I'm turning into the characters I'm playing. And there was something in me that was telling me I'm not going to die. I don't know what it was. I have a great faith, but there was some determination. Anyway, I went in. When I came out, I remember saying to my wife, going into recovery, I was sort of out of it, but I put my fingers up and I went, made a little incision, and then I made a big one. She went a little one, I fell back to sleep. And when I woke up, Chris came into the room and he just touched me on the knee and he said, you're not going to die. He said, we're going to deal with this. He said, we're going to bombard you because you're young and you're healthy, and we're going to get rid of this thing. So it was still touch and go. And I thought, okay, this is, my life's going to stop now. So I had all these plans of learning the Winterreise and learning all these arias and songs, and I started, and I thought I had books I was going to read and things I wanted to do. And after about a week, I thought, just let this thing happen. Just let the body recover and go through the process. Put on a huge amount of weight, which is the prednisone. And then when I did start coming back to vocalise, there was a freshness, a brightness, and a freedom in the voice, which surprised me. But I thought, well, if I'm putting two and two together, maybe that was a big part of it. I was sort of hunkered down by all that.
Yes, when you were talking about the voice becoming darker.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
What did you do over those 12 months? I mean, you obviously focused on getting better. But
I did. Well, the next thing was the Secret Garden, of course. And I was still on chemotherapy. I was still on oral chemotherapy while we were doing the Secret Garden. So, you know, I was getting tired. And there was one moment, this is probably a bit too, won't make it too graphic, but we were rehearsing and we were doing the show. And was in Brisbane, and I woke up one morning and I noticed there was blood on my pillow, and I thought, oh God, what's this? Is something new? And what had happened was that I had this little, like a blood blister on my ear near the drum, which had burst. And any a particular tone split into three. And in those days, we were listening to that ba 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 da ba ba da da of Current Affair with Jana Fent.
Yeah.
and I was getting ready to go into the show. And I heard that. I said, they changed the tune. They've changed the theme. No. Well, it's gone into threes. It's splitting. So all the horns were going to threes. And so I went to work. I couldn't pitch a thing because anything that had brass in it, couldn't pitch. And I said, I'm sorry. And I was trying to, you know, I was getting what I could out of it. So I ended up, I wasn't allowed to fly. So I had to go back. I finished, I missed 2 weeks of the show. Got into, and Phoebe was one. She just turned one at the time. So we got into this car that was given to us and we drove from Brisbane to Sydney. And I recovered. It was 3 weeks later and the thing had calmed down and I was fine again. But what was happening, the flap was moving as the vibrations were coming in. And the cilia was sort of breaking around it. And that was it was a bit scary, you know, but it did heal. It was fine.
Yeah. What now?
What now? I mean, that was, you know.
Did you know Secret Garden before you embarked on it? I mean, you
heard
the cast
recording? No, actually. John mentioned that there was this beautiful show and it was on Broadway and Mandy Patinkin was playing this role and I thought, okay, I know Mandy. And so I got a recording and listened to it. There were the highlights of. And I thought, this is beautiful, really beautiful. And then embarked on that. And a little scary because it was the first time coming out without the old Anthony look, you know. And it's a funny, funny story. It's funny. Everything's funny in retrospect, isn't it? But we opened and the first scene is for Archie is to come out of the door. I heard someone crying. So I came out of this door, which is all the lovely decoupage set, and I had the design. I thought, oh, this is a beautiful design. Edwardian, full beard, long hair, fabulous, the hump. and I would start, and it was English, and it was quite tenorial, and I changed the voice, so it was, you know, bright. And apparently, people were writing in, saying, we want our money back, Anthony Warlow's not in the show. And I'm thinking, this is the retrospect part now. Okay, so, light travels faster than sound. The first thing they see is this bearded guy with long hair. That's not the guy that had cancer, that was bald,
yes.
That was on the television. Yes. And then the voice is not the phantom that we heard. It's this... And they, unbeknownst to me, they were getting all these letters. So when Susan Shulman came back for the Melbourne season, she said, we're not seeing your lovely smile. We're not seeing if we want to get, maybe take the beard off. I said, but no, this is the character. He's this dark, you know, it's almost a Heathcliff kind of role.
It was that gothic look.
That's right. Yeah. And it was beautiful. Yeah. The design was beautiful. And they said, well, I said, look, I feel uncomfortable about that. And they said, well, what about taking the moustache off? I said, with a beard, I'm going to look like an Amish salesman is what I'm going to look like. So I said, okay, well, let's take the whole beard off, leave the chops so they can see that it's me. But it's still, I've got a, you know, full head of hair. Mm-hmm. So I was a little disappointed that they, you know, and dare I say, we're actors after all. And we are meant to embody another character. And I found it really strange. And I didn't discover until later that they said this is why, because they got so many letters of complaint.
You could have done an announcement in this evening's performance of Oliver Archibald Craven.
We'll be played by yes.
Anthony Waller.
Yes, a hirsute Anthony Waller.
Yeah.
Murder, greed, corruption, exploitation, adultery, treachery, and all that jazz. So begins the international multi-award winning musical, Chicago. It's the longest running musical on Broadway. And this scorching hot masterpiece is coming to Perth, Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney, starring Anthony Warlow as Billy Flynn. Don't miss the final installment of Stage's conversation with Anthony Warlow, where he continues to provide unique insight to his stellar career and craft. That's next time on the Stages Podcast. Thanks for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have your company. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time.